Chapter 40. The House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee hearing on economic aid to African nations, chaired by Frederick Daggett, opened to a half-empty conference chamber and a platoon of board reporters. Daggett was flanked by Democrat Earl Hunt of Iowa and Republican Roscoe Myers of Oregon. Lauren Smith sat off by herself near one end of the table. The hearing stretched into the afternoon as representatives of several African governments made their pitch for monetary aid. It was 4 o'clock when Hiram Lusana took his turn and sat down before the subcommittee. The chamber was crowded now. Photographers stood on seats, their flashbulbs stabbing the walls, while reporters began furiously scribbling on notepads or muttering into tape recorders. Lusana paid no attention to the commotion. He sat poised at the table, like a croupier who knew the odds were in his favor. "General Lusana," said Daggett, "welcome to our hearing. I think you know the procedures. This is purely a preliminary fact-finding session. You will be allowed 20 minutes to state your case. Afterward, the committee will put their inquiries to you. Our opinions and findings will later be reported to the House Foreign Affairs Committee as a whole." "I understand," said Lusana. "Mr. Chairman," Daggett turned to Lauren. "Yes, Congresswoman Smith."
"I must object to the appearance of General Lusana at this hearing on the grounds that he does not represent an established African government."
An undercurrent of murmurs swept the room. "It is true," Lusana said, leveling his gaze at Lauren, "I represent no established government. I do, however, represent the free soul of every black on the African continent."
"Eloquently put," said Lauren, "but rules are rules. You cannot turn a deaf ear to the pleas of millions of my people over a technicality."
Lusana sat immobile, his voice almost too soft for those in the back of the room to hear. "A man's most prized possession is his nationality. Without it, he is nothing. In Africa, we are in a fight to claim a nationality that rightfully belongs to us. I am here to beg for black dignity. I do not ask for money to buy arms. I do not ask for your soldiers to fight alongside ours. I plead only for the necessary funds to buy food and medical supplies for the thousands who have suffered in their war against humanity."
It was a masterful performance, but Lauren was not succored by it.
"You are a clever man, General. If I argue your appeal, I'll be condoning your presence at this hearing."
"My objection still stands."
Daggett made an imperceptible nod to one of his aides in the background and turned to Earl Hunt.
"Congresswoman Smith's protest is duly noted. How say you, Congressman Hunt?"
While Daggett was polling Hunt and Roscoe Myers for their opinions, his aide moved behind Lauren and handed her a large white envelope.
"What is this?"
"I was told to tell you it is most urgent that you open the envelope now, ma'am."
Then he hastily turned away and left the chamber through a side door. Lauren undid the unsealed flap of the envelope and eased out one of several 8x10 photographs. It had captured her naked body, entwined with pits, in one of a wild series of orgiastic positions. Quickly, she shoved the photo back in the envelope, her face gone white, reflecting fear and disgust. Daggett turned to her.
"Congresswoman Smith, we seem to have a hung committee. Congressman Hunt and I agree that General Lusana should be heard. Congressman Myers stands with you. As chairman of this hearing, may I prevail upon you in the interest of fair play to permit the general to speak his piece?"
Lauren felt the hairs on the back of her neck stiffen. Daggett was leering at her. It was all there in his expression. He was no stranger to the contents of the envelope. She struggled to contain the sickness that was rising in her throat, suddenly realizing that Felicia Collins had sold her out to Lusana's cause. Silently, she cursed her stupidity in allowing herself to be set up as naively as a teenage runaway with a big city pimp.
"Congresswoman Smith," Daggett said, prompting her.
There was no out. Daggett controlled her now. She lowered her eyes and trembled.
"Mr. Chairman," she said in total defeat, "I withdraw my objection."
Barbara Gore, at 43, still cut the figure of a Vogue fashion model.
She remained trim and had shapely legs, and her high cheekboned features had yet to flesh with age. She had once had an affair with Dale Jarvis, but that had long since passed through the sexual phase, and now she was simply a good friend as well as his personal secretary. She sat across from his desk, those beautiful legs crossed at an angle comfortable only to women and showy to the male eye. Jarvis, however, took no notice of them. He sat engrossed in dictation. After a while, he abruptly broke off and began probing through a mountainous batch of highly classified reports.
"Perhaps if you tell me what it is you're looking for," Barbara said patiently, "I can help you."
"A status check on all existing battleships. I was promised delivery for today." She sighed and reached into the pile and extracted a stapled sheaf of blue papers.
"Been on your desk since 8 this morning."
There were times when Barbara was moved to exasperation over Jarvis's sloppy work habits, but she had long ago learned to accept his idiosyncrasies and flow with the tide.
"What does it say?"
"What do you want it to say?" she asked. "You haven't bothered to tell me what you're after."
"I want to buy a battleship, of course. Who has one for sale?"
Barbara shot him a dour expression and studied the blue papers.
"I'm afraid you're out of luck. The Soviet Union has one left, which is used to train naval cadets. France has long since scrapped hers. Same with Great Britain, even though she still keeps one on the rolls for the sake of tradition."
"The United States?" 5 of them have been preserved as memorials."
"What are their present locations?"
"They're enshrined in the states they were named after: North Carolina, Texas, Alabama, and Massachusetts."
"You said 5.
The Missouri is maintained by the Navy in Bremerton, Washington. Oh, I almost forgot. The Arizona is still sentimentally kept on naval rolls as a commissioned ship."
Jarvis put his hands behind his head and stared at the ceiling. "I seem to recall the battle wagons Wisconsin and Iowa were tied up at the Philadelphia Navy Yard a few years back."
"Good memory," said Barbara. "According to the report, the Wisconsin went to the shipbreakers in 1984.
And the Iowa?
"Sold for scrap." Jarvis rose and walked to the window. He looked out, hands in pockets, for several moments. Then he said, "The Wild Rose folder." As if reading his thoughts, Barbara pointed to its cover.
"I have it."
"Send it over to John Gossard in the Africa section and tell him the operation made damn fine reading."
"Is that all?"
At the same moment, a small double-ender whaleboat dropped anchor 100 yards off Walnut Point, Virginia, and swung slowly around until its bow split the incoming tide. Patrick Fox unfolded a worn old deck chair and erected it on the narrow stern deck, barely fitting the ends between the bulwarks. Next, he propped a fishing pole against the helm and threw its hookless line over the side. He had just opened a picnic basket and was lifting out a large wedge of Cheshire cheese and a bottle of Cutty Sark when a tug towing 3 heavily laden trash scows acknowledged him with a passing signal blast from its whistle. Fox waved back and braced his feet as the wash from the plodding vessels rocked his little whaleboat. Fox noted the time of the tug's passing in a notebook. The battered deck chair creaked in protest as he lowered his huge body onto its cushioned slats. Then he ate a cut of the Cheshire and took a swig from the bottle. Every commercial ship or pleasure boat that passed by the seemingly drowsing fisherman was sketched into the notebook. The time of their appearance, heading, and speed were also recorded. One sighting interested Fox more than most. He kept a pair of binoculars trained on a Navy missile destroyer until it disappeared beyond the land point, carefully observing the empty missile mounts and the relaxed attitude of the deck crew. Toward late evening, a light shower began to splatter against the scarred and paint-cracked deck. Fox loved the rain. During storms at sea, he'd often stood and faced their furies on his ship's bridge wing, later upbraiding his junior officers who preferred hot tea and the creature comforts of the control room. Even now, Fox ignored the shelter of a small cabin and elected to remain on deck, donning a slicker to protect his skin and clothes from the damp. He felt good. The rain cleansed the air in his lungs,
The thick richness of the cheese filled his belly, and the scotch made his veins fairly glow. He allowed his mind to roam free, and soon it began flashing images of his lost family. The smells of his farm in Natal came to his nostrils, and the sound of Myrna's voice calling him to dinner sounded clear and distinct to his ears. 4 hours later, he jerked his thoughts back to reality as the tug, its tow of scows now empty, came into view on a return heading. Quickly, he stood and jotted down the number and position of the navigation lights. Then Fawkes weighed anchor, started the engine, and eased into the wake of the last scow in line as it slipped by.